Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press. We publish news, analysis, and perspectives on issues at the intersection of tech and democracy. On July 16th, Hugging Face, a company that provides a platform for AI models, datasets, and other machine learning applications, posted a security incident disclosure to its blog about an intrusion to its infrastructure. But this was no typical hack. The company said, quote, "It was driven end-to-end by an autonomous AI agent system," unquote, matching what it said is the agentic attacker scenario the industry has been forecasting. A few days later, OpenAI posted to its blog that the agentic attacker was in fact, quote, "driven by a combination of OpenAI models with, quote, reduced cyber refusals for evaluation purposes while being internally tested on a benchmark of cyber capabilities," unquote. OpenAI called it an unprecedented cyber incident involving, quote, "state-of-the-art cyber capabilities," and said it was responding accordingly, a framing that many observers regarded as an attempt to shift the blame onto its AI rather than the decisions taken by executives and engineers that created the circumstances in which the incident occurred. Nevertheless, cybersecurity experts say it points to an important shift in the threat landscape, one with important implications for domestic U.S. and international debates over AI governance and the security implications of the technology. To better understand these developments, I spoke to two individuals who are following the details closely.
My name is Vinh Nguyen. I am the Senior Fellow for AI at the Council on Foreign Relations.
I'm Graham Webster. I'm a lecturer and research scholar in the program on geopolitics, technology, and governance at Stanford University, and I lead the DigiChina project there.
I'm very pleased to have you both here, and Graham, pleased to have you again on the podcast. Then I'm going to start with you. I was looking through some of the things that you've written lately for the council. And in a piece in May, you talked about the sort of 30-year trajectory of cybersecurity and some of the assumptions that have been in place for a long time. You talked about the idea that cybersecurity has rested on three assumptions in particular: the idea that sophisticated attacks would remain expensive, that identity systems built for humans could extend to whatever came next, and that human judgment would remain in the path of consequential decisions. You talked about, you know, some things that had, you know, really kind of shaken those assumptions at the time. You talked about them as bolts of lightning. One was a November incident where Anthropic disclosed China state-sponsored actors using Claude, apparently, for various exploits. Another was the Mythos moment. Have we had another bolt of lightning this week, learning about what's happened with this OpenAI, quote-unquote, rogue agent, which escaped its sandbox and wandered off and, you know, did various meddling at Hugging Face? Is this another bolt of lightning? How serious is this? What does it mean?
Yes. So, you know, I mean, this is another bolt of lightning, but I think we anticipated this third bolt a while back. I would say that for any frontier AI capabilities, the ability to discover vulnerabilities have been known. But we also test, if you look at some of the UK AI security institutes, you know, testing on autonomy, we know this is happening. And so within the community and those who work in the frontier labs, you know, we all know that we have to find ways to sandbox and control these capabilities, knowing that it can act autonomously if we let it run for long horizon tasks. So this bolt of lightning is anticipated. We just didn't know where and when. I would have anticipated that it would come from like a cyber criminal group or whatnot to do this. But in this case, you know, unfortunately, it was an OpenAI set of models that was able to break through the sandbox. So I think this is a really good lesson to learn that security controls are key to manage and constrain and steer these capabilities, be able to have controllabilities of models and be able to align the model so that it doesn't do something like this is challenging, but should be done as a safeguard. And lastly, that we have to have monitoring in place. So when failure modes like this happen, we actually know what's going on and be able to intervene if we can do it. So this is not like somehow out of the blue. I think we anticipated it and it came. And I think people should not be surprised that this can happen with frontier AI capabilities.
And there's been a lot of this kind of discussion online about, you know, the extent to which OpenAI appears to have almost spun this, as a kind of marketing ploy to say, oh, look how dangerous our advanced agents are, advanced models are. What do you make of that? You know, is this kind of a both things are true at once? Like maybe OpenAI is somehow able to do what it's done in past to kind of portray its models in this regard as extremely powerful and dangerous. And yet at the same time, I don't know, this is a real phenomenon that's occurred and one that clearly concerns cybersecurity experts. Where do we separate the hype from the reality here?
It is a real incident and we should take it seriously. When Anthropic released Mythos and talked about the ability to find vulnerabilities, I can tell you lots of people in the cybersecurity community took it as hype or a marketing ploy. And then they rushed to figure out if it's real or not, and they realize it's real, and then there's a problem. And so I think that for so long, the cybersecurity community, you know, make assumptions about the context, the adversaries, and the conditions that we're in. But the time is changing, and the assumptions, like I mentioned, identities, sophisticated actors no longer, you know, require, you know, nation states and resources to do, right? Sophisticated attacks can be done by, like, anyone. And those are the assumptions that I think we have to check. Otherwise, we walk into this new environment believing naively that the controls and the practices that we had will work. And I can tell you that it will not. And so we have to be on guard, you know, as we introduce these new technologies into the ecosystem. I would take it seriously as an incident. No lab would want this incident. And so I would minimize the debate, discussion that is a hype.
Graham, I want to bring you in here. As with, it seems like everything these days, there's a thread of this that sort of relates to this broader discourse about US versus China in terms of models and capabilities and open versus closed and all of these sort of themes and topics that we've discussed. But in this particular case, it turns out Hugging Face, I suppose, felt it needed to turn to Chinese open model in order to help fend off this attack, which it learned later was coming from OpenAI's agents. I don't know, what does this tell us? How is this an entry point, I suppose, into some of the things you're looking at, this broader geopolitics of AI and these kind of considerations between the US and China?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, it's a strange event. I immediately want to disclaim any, you know, detailed technical understanding about what went on in the cybersecurity incident, both because I'm not a technical person in that way and because I think a lot of the details are not fully public. But what I understand from reporting is that the incident response team at Hugging Face initially went to work trying to figure out what was going on, and they turned to some US models, some of the paid ones from OpenAI and Anthropic, and they ran into cybersecurity guardrails in the way that those models are allowed to be used, you know, that are designed to stop people from using those models for offensive cyber purposes, but in effect here undermined the ability of Hugging Face to, you know, to use them for defense. Now, Hugging Face is very lucky in this situation. They run a massive AI inference and model distribution system. So they had on hand the ability to run full-size versions of essentially any open weights model they want from China. So the reporting suggests that they then turned to those, and that tooling helped them respond to the event. So, you know, this sets up a really interesting thicket of dilemmas. You've got US model providers want to put cybersecurity guardrails on their most advanced models to prevent misuse. There's also US government policy that, you know, affects this type of deployment. And at the same time, Chinese open models that don't have the same guardrails, especially when they're run on one's own infrastructure, are accessible and they're useful for this stuff. Now, I can't compare whether, you know, the new Kimi model from Moonshot AI is just as exquisitely powerful as Fable or Mythos from Anthropic for cyber uses, but clearly it's useful. And so you have the obvious point that people can use the Chinese models for defensive purposes, and probably for offensive purposes out there. And the guardrails exist probably on, you know, the Chinese model providers' hosted services are going to have more guardrails than if you install the open model on your own. So it sets up this weird distributional dilemma where U.S. actors, both government and private, want to control cyber misuse. I think most of the Chinese labs and the Chinese government would also like to control cyber misuse. But when there are open models available, you know, people can use it as they please. And in this case, Hugging Face got some good defensive utility out of it.
What does this tell us about some of these considerations about constraining models on both sides? I mean, we've had, you know, just in the last bit, this moment where these export control directives were used to put constraint on Fable and Mythos from Anthropic, you know, since released, I suppose. Also, some rumors or discussion out of Beijing about the possibility of constraining releases. What do we know about that? Maybe what's the most up-to-date view from Beijing, I suppose? You've been paying attention to some of the events there, some of the very public events, including the World AI Congress and also Xi Jinping's big speech.
Yeah, so it's been a big week for Chinese government communication on AI and AI policy. Last weekend in Shanghai, the annual World AI Conference was held. And for the first time, China's top leader, Xi Jinping, gave the keynote address. You know, last year, I think it was the premier, so another, you know, the number two official, but there's always somebody big, you know, but this is the top guy. And so he gave really the most visible top leader speech on AI that I can think of. And I've been watching Chinese AI policy closely since 2017. A lot of people were looking at this because there had been reporting that China might try to export control its AI technology. And maybe that would include preventing the transfer of the weights of open models to foreign users. It was always a little confusing if you could have an open model that was only available in China. It sort of recalls these debates about encryption and the early internet where the US wanted to control some special math and people were printing it on t-shirts and stuff like that to show how silly this was. But it was totally possible that the Chinese government could crack down and say, we're going to control the distribution of models at a certain level of performance. So a lot of people looked at the Xi Jinping speech and said, okay, well, he's actually talking about continuing openness and distribution. And the word open source was even said. I think the signals are pretty unclear. There's a very strong Chinese government pitch to the world that they are the ecosystem that is open, that's going to help especially global South countries, but also others develop AI without being reliant on centralized providers in the style that the US labs are doing. But the speech and all of Chinese policy also emphasizes that there's need for security and safety. And there's this longstanding Chinese watchword of secure and controllable technology. And it's utterly conceivable that, you know, some capability would be demonstrated that the Chinese government would decide, okay, this being completely open for anyone to use in the world is not compatible with our secure and controllable style. So, you know, for now, the signals are that China is still going to be releasing models openly. The Kimi K3 model came out to much attention internationally with apparently very strong performance alongside that conference, you know, and the models just keep coming. But I wouldn't bet on it going forever. And the last thing I'll say is there's an obvious common ground for US and China here, whether the governments appreciate it or not, which is that for, you know, third-party misuse, cyber criminals, terrorists, other types of risks, or even really for using it against each other, both governments and both countries have to worry about cyber defense in a landscape where, you know, AI capability can supercharge offense as well as defense. So they may be able to reach a meeting of minds, and there's a kind of quietly developing new channel on AI between the two countries that we don't know a lot about.
I want to add what Graham said. I think the Chinese may end up have to find a way forward if there is a, you know, a major incident that will be quite disruptive. You know, I can think of, you know, say if K3 is released, I can just see that there's so many cyber criminals out there. And I'm sure that both the Chinese and the US government agree that they don't want cyber criminals, you know, going after their own citizens, right? And so there will be a case, a likely case scenario where cyber criminals can run these things autonomously and jeopardize and harm both, you know, the Chinese and, you know, American citizens. And the reaction may end up with, you know, you see what happened with all these Chinese models aiming after, you know, U.S. citizens, or if it takes out some infrastructure in China, right? And so I think, hopefully, there is an incident where the two governments can agree that maybe we have to sort out this open weight debate. But I don't think they will agree to anything unless there is a major incident that will have to force their hands. And so I don't think the strategy of open weight and just let them all go at this level of capabilities and this level of diffusion will bode well for really anyone outside of, you know, the criminals. You know, my take is like, you know, my community in cybersecurity community keep on debating, you know, we can use this for defense, we can use this for offense. My take, you know, people, is that criminals can use these things faster than the defenders can. And defenders, you know, have to put the resource to defend like a very large attack surface across the enterprises and things that they have to protect. Criminals don't have to do that. They can actually just run these and be able to get to what they need. And so my take is that it sounds theoretically right that, yes, it can benefit both sides, but I think it will benefit the cyber criminal first until you get to a level of consequences where you decide that maybe we don't tolerate that anymore. So my take is that in the next few months, it wouldn't be surprising that there are more cases coming out that are quite consequential that we have yet heard.
Maybe, Vin, I'll stick with you just on a question to follow up on that. You know, I mean, you spent decades in the national security establishment. What do you think are the kind of dilemmas or the kind of decision matrix that the people in the Trump administration right now are facing on this question in particular? You know, is there a detente we can reach with China, or is there any indications that we will kind of just carry on with this sort of like race mentality, which I want to come back to you on, Graham, as well, because I know you have this sort of way of complicating the idea of who's in the lead. But Vin, I don't know, what do you make of what's going on at the top rungs of the administration, what we can see from the signals that are coming from those individuals?
Yeah, I mean, I worked through the U.S.-China cyber discussion for more than a decade. I can tell you that trust is quite low from the beginning. And so you have to really trust the other side, which is unlikely at this point. The second is making sure that we understand what we are talking about based on like the definitions that we use, right? I think, you know, the Chinese and, you know, Chinese government and the U.S. government may agree on controllability. And as Graham, you know, he may tell you more in terms of maybe the ambiguity and controllability of AI. And so I think there has to be an incident that is consequential that will force both sides to come to, you know, to a discussion and to have a meaningful conversation. And I think the vulnerabilities that could be discovered in the global financial systems and all these systems that, you know, glue the world together could be a point of discussion on how China and U.S. can work together, areas where we can find ways to agree, understand how we measure and how we understand about risk. No one wants the proliferations of dangerous weapons that AI can augment, you know, bad people, criminals to do. So there's a lot of things that we can agree on if we try. But it has to come with like some level of agreement of what we need to do, and which is forced by an incident, and building the trust little by little to get that right. But if the U.S. and China don't come together on this, I think it will be impossible to have any global conversation on the governance of AI at this point.
Well, Vin, I don't love that. Some kind of Mr. Robot style destabilizing hack or something like that that messes everything up. Doesn't sound awesome. But and Graham, bringing you in, what do you make? What brings people to the table? Or how might we complicate, you know, even this notion of what it means to be in the lead in a way that could be productive?
Yeah, well, first, I'm going to go out on a limb and endorse a piece of writing that I haven't read yet, although I've heard some of the arguments from the author before publication. Matt Sheehan from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace has a new commentary out on a concept he's been working on called AI safety in parallel. I hope I don't do violence to it by summarizing what I've heard him talk about, but the idea is basically it's going to be really hard to get these two to trust each other and really kind of make a deal. But there may be substantive measures that both governments and AI ecosystems can take that actually mitigate some risks through various types of contact. And there's track to dialogue and there's lab to lab. And there is some hope there. And so I'll stop talking about something I haven't read yet, but I recommend people read it because I know that Matt's been working quite hard on that. Now, you know, as for the AI race thing, one thing that I think was really helpful about the way that Vin has been laying out the cybersecurity risks is that I think a lot of the time we hear about, well, our country must be ahead in AI so that we can stop the other country from hurting us with their AI. And for me, this is sort of a strategic miss, because the reality for several years has been that if the United States or China was determined to really harm the other in cyber, they both had the capability to do it. US offensive cyber and Chinese offensive cyber could wreak significant havoc on the other side. But you'd be in the conditions of war. That would be very bad. I mean, there's all sorts of activity below the level of war. But really, if people wanted to throw it at one another, you know, these are highly capable offensive cyber apparatus. The common risk that advances is third parties, you know, whether it's criminals or terrorists or you know, just anybody who previously wasn't enabled to cause significant havoc. I think that's really important, you know, but, you know, I had this idea the other day, what is it really? What is the US lead? Is it just that there's a couple of models that, you know, people talk about, well, they're 6 months ahead, or they're 9 months ahead, or 18 months ahead, or 3 months ahead of the best Chinese model on some metric. So that means that there should be some little slice of what AI can do, or really what a person or an organization can do with AI today, that can only be done with that more advanced US model. But that got me thinking, there's actually a bunch of stuff that you can only do with an open model that you can install on your own infrastructure and that you can run without the permission or observation of the model provider. So in a way, you can imagine that there are exclusive capabilities that US provides. Currently, it looks like, yes, still there's, at the top end of performance on various metrics, there's an edge there that the US labs have. And that will solve some problems that people can't solve with the Chinese options. At the same time, no US model is providing that sort of near frontier level capability in a way that you can download into your own corporate network or into your own government operations network and run without any interference or observation or data risks from the provider. So China then has this lead in just in providing, really, it's the world has this open lead in certain things that the closed US models won't provide. Because anyway, the point of talking about this is that the idea of a single AI race really falls apart unless you define what it is. It's a race to do what? And often the implicit destination is the vague idea of AGI or superintelligence. And I just don't think that's enough. I think analytically, when we're thinking about the situation between US and Chinese models and what open weights models mean for the business model of US companies, like, this is all, you know, a specific question of who can do what and for what cost and in what sort of logistical arrangement using the different technologies. And in that situation, it looks like a much more complicated landscape where some things are going to work better with a Kimi than with a Claude, if only because you can afford the Kimi.
Can I jump in, Graham? I love what he said. It's really about the outcomes. I think the American people want, if there is a race, the outcomes would be able to, you know, advanced life sciences so we can cure cancer and fight diseases, be able to improve our national security and defenses, and be able to, you know, maybe accelerate nuclear fusion so that we can lower prices, right? Like, these are the race that I think race to the top, like, to really better everyone and humanity alike. But absolutely, I do not want the U.S. to beat China in domestic surveillance, which China's really good. So let's not compare ourselves on things that don't really matter. And I think the whole discussion lacks any outcome, and lacking any outcome, I don't buy, you know, anything, because it's so, you know, it's so ambiguous. And so I hope that we don't discuss about some crazy races, on 5 or 10 races, as long as the races are to deliver something better for humanity.
Then I want to kind of ask you a little bit about this most recent piece you have for CFR. You're sort of responding to these reports that the administration is potentially preparing to announce something, maybe a new regulatory body, a FINRA style body, perhaps, that would, you know, make various judgments about the safety of AI models before their release, and also, you know, engage with the industry on these questions. You're obviously hoping to see that if something like that does come along, that it's structured in the most appropriate way, at least from your perspective. I don't know, if the administration does do something like that, what should it look like?
Yeah, thank you, Justin. Really, the background is that Demis Hassabis, who's the CEO of Google DeepMind, proposed a, you know, self-regulatory organization to provide a level of stability and predictability in the ecosystem. It is very hard for the frontier AI companies and the hyperscalers and the big, you know, tech companies to guess what models could be released, which model could suddenly be reported to be so dangerous that they cannot deploy. And so I think that is quite disturbing to the U.S. market, just the whole ecosystem who are developing technologies in order to to do useful things. My work here is with Elham Tabassi from Brookings. She was the former NIST chief AI advisor, along with my colleague Kat Duffy at the council, who's leading the lead AI effort. Three of us are really, we do really care that whatever is proposed, that we want this to be a long-term success, and has the support of not only just the industry, the government, but also the people who are benefiting or will be impacted by it, along with our allies. Because, you know, our thinking is that if we rushed into some institution, we will build it, it will take years to do it, and then suddenly it fails because we fail to design it from the beginning and try to resolve the problems. It is so much easier to fix problems that we can identify today, then try to fix it, a few years down the road, because there will be many interests and there's a lot of things that we have to do and we have to undo the whole thing. And that will cost a lot of time for us to master a technology and govern a technology that is so, so meaningful and so powerful for all of us. And so what we are really looking for is that whatever the design, the regulatory, the legislative umbrella of this is, as long as we have a level of independence in evaluation and benchmarking, so that the evaluated is not setting the terms on what to be evaluating on, right? Basically, that is like, no one will trust that, unfortunately. And I don't think the labs, you know, all of them want a level of independence in terms of third-party auditing. The second is the national security. Like, no longer can we just somehow talk about the commercial and the economic progress, and then we'll somehow, you know, we have some national security apparatus sitting on the side, not connected. And that is how we end up with disruptive decision-making, because one side will, you know, then talk to the other side, and suddenly we have this, like, strange, erratic outcome. So the national security community should be involved right from the beginning to address any national security concern. And lastly, is really the legitimacy. You know, if we are going to produce American AI stack, that need to be marketable and trusted with our allies, with the people who want to sell the products to. It cannot just be run by us, and somehow when we sell it to the Europeans or the UK or the Global South, suddenly they're like, oh, it's a US product, so we trust it. No, it has to be much more independent in terms of like trust, but verify many times in terms of the reliability, the security and the safety of the so-called product. And if we don't demonstrate that level of transparency and accountability to our allies, no one will trust us. And they will trust things like Chinese products that may not have, you know, that they have a control of, but they don't have a way to verify or assure it. So that's really our concern on how to address it. And we list up a variety of things to ensure that we can undo, right, unpack who is going to set the standard, who is going to set and fund the infrastructure to do such evaluation, and how do we fund and empower the independent evaluators who are going to evaluate such product on the standard. So we can do it right from the beginning. We will save ourselves like a decade of trouble ahead.
Well, I want to double down on maybe the international dimensions of the question about how to do this, and Graham, maybe bring you in, because another thing that feels like just, you know, hot news coming out of China, the launch of this World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Organization, which I think, you know, wants to be the alternative, right? Wants to be the standard setter and kind of maybe answer some of the questions that, you know, whatever a U.S. body might think are its remit, it would like to do that, but in a more multilateral way, perhaps, at least from the start.
Yeah, I think you have to read the initiatives like this from the Chinese government with both a genuine lens and a cynical lens. Often in Washington, you just get the cynical lens, so I'll give both. But I think there's a genuine desire in the Chinese government and among the top leadership to be seen as an enabler of development around the world and to share the kind of development miracle that China feels that it has had in the last several decades, and that has certainly been visible to anybody who could witness China sort of 40 years ago versus today. You know, I think that's genuine. I think they really want to do that. Of course, it also comes with being able to sell your products and having political influence. But I think this idea of being, you know, a leader of the developing world is an honestly held motivation. And it's something that Chinese leaders and Chinese people are proud of. And sometimes they can be justifiably proud when products actually do provide public goods. The cynical side is more familiar to an American audience, is that it would be a way to exert influence and displace U.S. influence and displace the influence of small d democratic and human rights respecting systems. The World AI Cooperation Organization it's a little hard to tell what precisely it is. It was announced that I think 29 countries had signed on to it. The idea that this organization would exist was announced a year ago at the previous World AI Conference, which I happened to attend, and it took them a year to announce the initial signatories. I think as we're recording this, the document that they signed is still not released, but the organization's meant to be headquartered in Shanghai, and it's supposed to be about sharing the wealth and also about developing international governance and norms for AI use. Now, the signatory list did come out, and it's kind of a negative space of countries that the United States would work with. And I don't have the list in front of me, but, you know, suffice it to say, it's not grabbing a bunch of NATO allies or, you know, sort of Five Eyes type countries that are core U.S. partners. And there is a Chinese initiative that does include some of those U.S. partners. So what you end up with is a sort of a Chinese-led club and then the potential for a U.S.-led club. And I guess for development purposes, this could be okay. I mean, you could just have two separate groups of people trying to do good. But if you're trying to solve problems and do control of risks and governance, I really believe that no really effective governance or risk management framework for the sort of LLM era of AI can really work without both the United States and China somehow signed on. And maybe they can do it in parallel. Maybe they don't have to sign the same proposal. But without including both of those, you're missing at least one of the two countries that that produces really powerful models. And so that's just super crucial. And I think that, you know, we can look at those diplomatic initiatives as potential venues for the diffusion of good ideas. And of course, all this sort of the cynical narratives about spreading influence and trying to get business for a country's companies. And I'll throw that accusation at the United States too. I mean, remember that when we spoke last year, Justin, it was the Chinese conference had just gone off and the U.S. AI plan, I forget the exact title, had come out. And the U.S. plan was boasting of building AI dominance. And, you know, this is not a very friendly pitch to the world. It's saying, you shall buy our stuff and, by the way, follow our rules. The Chinese pitch is a little more friendly, but neither will, in my opinion, kind of reach a global problem-solving modus operandi that without kind of breaching the divide.
Yeah, my take is that trust is broken everywhere. And, you know, folks may not trust, you know, the Chinese government or the U.S. government. And so in order to operate in a world where trust is quite limited, all you have is really, if you don't have the capabilities, you can control it. You have to have an ability to verify, and you have to have an ability to have a trusted, you know, ecosystem for that verification that, you know, maybe governments are not involved. And I find that it is truly a strategic advantage for the U.S. You know, think of our financial systems, you know, even though it's not, you know, flawless here, but at least in some ways we learn to rely on, and the world we rely on, some part of the global, you know, ecosystem of the financial services to validate, to verify financial assets. And so there is some solution. I am optimistic. But I think, you know, as you know, soon as we get the governments involved, the geopolitics will show up, the national security work will show up, and then people will look that through that lens. So, you know, if we don't have that, is there a different alternative ways that we can build trust in the ecosystem and be able to allow people to verify, because they don't have to trust what we have to say, but at least they can verify and verify it independently. That's my thinking, is that may be a better outcome compared to the alternatives, which we have, like the two worlds, two big powers, you know, fighting each other on every little thing.
Well, I want to ask, and this may be a little ham-handed, this question, but I know that even this afternoon, there is a letter out from American AI firms about open source and open weight models. And I think also trying to basically influence, you know, the administration and maybe the discourse that's going on inside it about kind of what to do about these issues. But, you know, U.S., China, obviously concentrations of power, but American industry, its own concentration of power with its own voice. I don't know, Vin, how do you sort of think about that right now? What the industry wants, the dynamics of the industry, the, I don't know, financial situation that the industry's in? And Graham, I know, you know, you're watching that as well from a kind of question around, is this a bubble? Is it not? You know, are these investments going to play out? And clearly there's a lot of commercial considerations that are going on here as well.
But I find this era and timeline quite dramatic and ironic, just fascinating, is that all the major powers that we know of, well, the Wall Street, the big tech, like the big things, they feel powerless. And I'm like, really? Like, you should not be, right? And so when you read these through the lens, the assumption, maybe the underlying assumption and maybe the implicit assumption here is that the three frontier labs companies, right, be it Google DeepMind, Anthropic, OpenAI, the entire industry assess that they have so much power concentrated that they will, you know, from a lot of industries, right, that they will take our business away. They will take so-called our alpha, right? This is what we hear all over the place, away from the business that we run. So they are frustrated, upset, and they want a check and balance, a counterbalance to the proprietary models, and therefore support open source and be able to like do more of this work. I think the other charge I don't think is fully articulated or clear enough was that the industry is very concerned that the labs will somehow take the proprietary data, train something, and then outcompete them. This is a valid concern, and there's no way that you can trust giving a data to a lab and trust that they don't use that data for whatever purposes they want. There are contracts, there are things, but there's a lot of concern. So my take is that this is a way to pull back some powers that they see as concentrated in just a few hands. And this is a interesting dynamic that I think we should see it for what it is, rather than being critical that somehow, you know, this is a ploy, a hype, or something else. But I think this is truly a concern from industry on the shifting dynamics and power and opportunities for the future economy.
Yeah, so I'll jump in with a couple of things here. I mean, like Vin, I just find this to be kind of a dazzling, confusing moment in what everybody's arguing and what's going on and what the U.S. government might do. I made a little list of tools that the U.S. government could potentially use, according to various news reports and official statements, to restrict access to Chinese models. They could maybe put the Chinese companies on the entity list, but I think that's mostly about exporting things to those companies, so I don't know how that works. There's a thing called the ICTS rule, where the U.S. can ban transactions on ICT services, but that would really be like hosted providers only. And if I download it on my own infrastructure, I'm not sure if that touches it. There's the TikTok law, which is again, like you could go after the app stores. There's putting sanctions on the companies and making it impossible to transact with them. And maybe there's regulatory risk for US businesses, you know, but I could probably still do it in my garage. And then there's just this sort of warning and saying, oh, there's this security risk, which may be real or maybe not, but maybe to try to deter people from using it. It's all like, all these tools are being debated. And behind that, there's this question of like, why would the United States crack down on Chinese open source models? And I can see two basic arguments. One is that all open weights models are risky at a certain level. I think that's a kind of AI safety philosophical standpoint where they say like, look, the harms are just too big. We can't have these things out there. Bad actors will use them. They shouldn't be released. That's a principled stance, and it aligns with, I think, what Anthropic says and what a lot of researchers say. But it's also convenient because, you know, Anthropic's revenue is and OpenAI's revenue and DeepMind's revenue is challenged by cheaper token costs from some of the open weights models that can get a lot of work done for less money. And then there's, should we ban just Chinese open weights models? And that's the argument that some people are making. And that's just an explicitly competitive argument. And so I keep coming back to, you know, I am not going to be your market analyst here, but going around in the Bay Area at meetings and reading stuff online, there is this completely saturated consensus right now that the AI bubble, not is there one, the AI bubble has got to give. And the only question is when. Now, I get really nervous when there's such a broad consensus, but I find it frustrating that we don't get to evaluate the actual risk of open weights distribution, which I think is real, versus the real benefits also that people get out of it, out of the, you know, the inexpensive utility, the ability to control the data environment, et cetera. We don't get to have that debate in the United States without also having to ask, is this really just about trying to prevent a bunch of people's startup values going to zero? And the answer is we just can't have that. They aren't separate. These things are happening at the same time. There's no way around it. And I find that kind of amazing and frustrating. But I guess I would urge everyone to keep in mind that when you're hearing debates about going after some Chinese AI company or some product, there you have to think about real risks, and then you also have to think about ulterior motives. And you know, while in the Chinese government, I think, can be seen to capture the Chinese companies, you know, the companies can't really do anything big without government approval, or not really approval, but the government can tell them to stop, right? It's not a prior approval, but there is the ability of the government to intervene. I think in the US, we have to worry about which parts of the industry are capturing the government, because the government doesn't know what it wants to do independently on this, in my opinion. They're hearing different pleas from people on different sides of the debate who have vested interests, and some of whom also have honestly held philosophical and security beliefs. So call me confused, but it's definitely not boring.
I believe we'll have to end on a point of confusion, and perhaps with this particular topic, that was always going to be. But I think, at least from my perspective, listening to the two of you brought me a bit more clarity, at least on the questions I should be asking going forward. So I appreciate you both. Vin, Graham, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you, Justin, for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. And thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.